It's always a humbling experience to have what we thought we knew about something completely destroyed by the finding of new information, or maybe even old information that we weren't privy to. It's particularly embarrassing when we realize that we've talked about this particular subject, whether it's not something in world politics or something about scientific discovery or an understanding of the way in which our lives work. And we've shared about this subject with authority and with confidence to friends and to coworkers and to family members, only to realize that what we thought we'd understood was based upon either faulty information or urban legend, or maybe the accumulation of a variety of layers of things. This is the deep pain of the phone tree, where we think we have the right information about something really, really important, and we realize we're 13th on the caller list, and the information's changed by the time it's gotten to us. Embarrassing. Frustrating. Particularly when we thought we knew what we were talking about. And yet, for most of these things, it's not all that damaging, which is to say, it's not something over which we should constantly lose sleep, but in the realm of something like faith or in religion, it's a far weightier matter. When Jesus talks about things like this, he uses words like, you'd rather have a millstone tied around your neck than to get it wrong and lead others astray as well. And we don't have to look very far and wide to find examples of Christian faith, Christian peoples and leaders who are clearly operating from a faulty understanding of what the heart of the faith is all about. There are so many varied layers and expressions of it that at times the heart of the matter is lost. And the world looks at Christians and asks, what is really the truth in it? Because I look and I see so many different varieties of expressions of it and differing examples of what they think is the most important thing that should be paid attention to. What is it that I should really, really consider when looking at the Christian faith? Well, for the next number of weeks leading up to Easter, we're going to be embarking on this series, a series intended to look at the heart of the matter. And it's not going to be a reminder, you know, of simply things that we've maybe already known, but have kind of let some dust settle on. It will be a series in which we will be asking ourselves the question very clearly. Could it be that what I've always understood to be the heart of the matter really isn't? Could it be that my life and the way I've planned it, the way I've lived it, the way I've organized it has in fact been built upon maybe urban legends or layers of religiosity that really have nothing to do with the heart of what Jesus was all about and the truth he came to proclaim? That is to say, have we missed the mark? Not only in what we believe, but how we've lived. Well, today's discussion will set the stage as we look at the famous chapter of Luke 15. And today we want to look at three different things. We want to look at the people who are present for Jesus' teaching. Then we want to look at three similar parts of the parables. We read the two today, and many of you will have in your mind the parable of the prodigal son. And in all three parables, it has a description of lost things. And thirdly, we're going to be looking at another similar characteristic of all three parables, the joyful seekers. And in so doing, looking at the audience, we'll look at what is it that Jesus wants to communicate to his people. Secondly, when looking at these lost things, we want to rethink our concepts and categories for the discussion of sin. And thirdly, when we look at the joyful seekers, we want to reframe and maybe obliterate false understandings of what salvation is. First, to get to the heart of what this whole chapter is about, we need to see who Jesus is with, who he's talking to, and who he hopes is listening. Jesus never speaks in a vacuum. This is the one thing that I think is very important for Christians to understand. Jesus was not a traveling sage that just simply dispensed wisdom like you see in the old BC cartoon with the wise man on top of a hill, and people come up to him and he gives them a tidbit for the day. Jesus does not have collected sayings. Jesus had conversations with real people, in which wisdom obviously came out, but it's always in the context of a relationality. There is a conversation taking place. He's taking someone very seriously, even if their questions are bad, or even if their character is somewhat sketchy. Jesus is very personal, and this is precisely what we see in this case. Jesus is, as we learn, gathering together with a group of people who, interestingly, are willing listeners, tax collectors and sinners. They want to hear what Jesus says. Now, we have in our own mind's eye that these people can be typically labeled, right? These are the unreligious, so to speak. Maybe the outcasts. Maybe themselves disinterested in religion or in God or even in faith. And yet we see here a tremendously interesting point that these people who we might suggest would be those who would have no interest in talking about God are gathering around and intrigued by and even attracted to Jesus. And also present in this discussion is a group of unwilling listeners. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law. You can imagine them, close to the conversation, looking in a window, or maybe present in a large crowd. And for them, they are offended by Jesus' fraternization with sinners. They have two frustrations with Jesus. Not only is he welcoming them, but he's eating food with them. It's a big no-no. You eat a dinner with someone, it is a sign of your friendship. It is a sign of your welcoming and your hospitality into their home. To reject someone is a social sign in that regard, to not eat with them or to get up from a table when someone else were to sit down. You can imagine the Pharisees and the teachers of the law just simply steaming here at this point. The text says they muttered their disapproval. They didn't really ask Jesus why he was doing what he was doing. They had already passed their judgment on him. They just couldn't believe it. Jesus, though, decides to use this as a teaching moment. It comes out of him sitting at a table, eating food with outcasts, having religious onlookers look at him and say, "What on earth are you doing?" He says, "I'm going to say something then." And as we'll see, we've always thought that what he says is aimed at the outcasts. Hope for the outcasts. We'll see, though, in these three parables, he's also saying something very direct and very pointed to those of the religious order who are questioning Jesus' actions. And as we'll see at the very end, he's addressing two groups of lost people. The irreligiously lost and the religiously lost, whose only hope will be found in him. The parables that he gives first addresses the lost things. And in here we see Jesus' first confrontation with the Pharisees in terms of their understanding of what sin is. I had never thought of this before until Keller pointed this out. These two smaller parables that lead up to the big one in chapter 15 add some variety and dimension to the typical categories of sin. I mean, the Pharisees' way of looking at a person whom they would be disapproving of, who would they think is an outcast, not worthy of attention, certainly not worthy of eating fellowship with. Their category of sin would just simply be this: they are bad, and I'm trying to be good. They are clearly making bad choices of their own volition, and I am clearly leveraging my life towards that which is right. The question is, how is a person bad? Well, the Pharisees would simply say they chose poorly. They were bad, they chose the wrong path, they made the wrong mistakes in life, they are worthy of disdain. And to them, of course, the Pharisees, to themselves, the Pharisees chose wisely. They chose the right path. They did what was right. They should be honored for this. And Jesus' parable here directly confronts that. There are three lost things. The first is the lost sheep. How is the sheep lost? Wanders off. How does a sheep wander off? Because a sheep is stupid. It's just naturally ingrained. I mean, you can't get mad at a sheep for wandering off. It's like yelling at a child for crying, which I'm doing a lot of lately. You just can't help it. Second thing is a lost coin. How does an inanimate object get lost? It could jump off a shelf into the couch, right? Coins lost to the carelessness of the one who had it. And if the sheep is lost through its own foolishness, the coin is lost through the carelessness of its owner. In this third story, there's a lost son. How is the lost son lost? Well, chooses to leave. Willfulness. This is the life I want for myself. What Jesus is saying here to the Pharisees is there is a multidimensional view of sin here. There's a lot going on, a lot more than just characterizing people as bad and good. In fact, no one is good. But let's put this understanding of sin, for example, in these three categories, of which we could do many, many more. But let's put it to a practical test. You know, if we're looking at various issues that happen in the lives of a person, whether it is a propensity to lying or maybe a propensity to anger in really inappropriate ways. Well, what's the root cause of it? Mr. Smith has an anger problem. Can't control it. Its effects do great damage. What do we say about it? Well, is his problem genetic? Right? It's a part of the family tree. Is it just wired to blow steam whenever it gets mad? And, you saw it in the first generation, the second generation, the third generation. You shouldn't be surprised if you see it in the fourth. Right? Thus, is it a situation like the sheep? Just not something that can be helped, but needs to be at best managed, right? Or is the problem a result of a bad environment, right? Was he poorly raised? Was he conditioned in a culture that didn't frown upon just displays of anger? Was it modeled for him day in and day out in his life? That is it a situation like a lost coin? The child was mismanaged. The child was not taken care of and then grew to embody those things that were wrong. Or is this problem rooted in maybe a selfish nature or pride? That is the steam blow off because it's coldly and carefully calculated in order to manipulate, to get its way, and to create a life for himself? Is it a situation like the lost son? It's just chosen. Well, we could use a variety of examples to illustrate the point, but biblically speaking, sin is messy. It's complex. It has a variety of avenues. It just doesn't allow us to look at a person and categorize them as simply evil and then dismiss ourselves as good. Sin is inborn in us. It's magnified by sinful treatment and injustice, and it's deepened and shaped by our own choices, much larger than a Pharisee's understanding of it. A confrontation of the Pharisee's understanding here is deep. That we need to understand sin is much deeper than you just chose poorly. Lastly, Jesus' second challenge, if the first is to the understanding of sin, the second is our understanding of salvation. In all three stories, there is the story of the joyful seeker, one who goes after that which is lost and is quite excited to find. The question we would ask is, how is it that God is sought and found? What is the means by which people know the truth? How is it that we can claim that we ourselves know God? Now, differing religions offer different plans on how to do such a thing. But truth be told, most religions seem to agree that the answer can be found if we search hard enough for it. The key, therefore, is kind of a diligence, committing ourselves to the religious path, going and finding it. The problem with this understanding is that it seems to place the knowledge of God, an understanding of who He is, within our own hands. And even more so, it tends to place this religious quest solely in the hands of those who are the most highly motivated to find it or the most intelligent to understand it. And when this happens, when people look at religion and faith this way, the people who believe they found the answer, what do they say to those who haven't? If you just did what I did, you'd find it. If you just would understand the way I understood, you would believe it. And if you don't believe it, then the disdain comes. I just don't understand why you don't get it. I get it. Right? There's a disdain also that ends up building up. We're trying to find the way. We're trying to find the truth, but it seems like you don't even care. You're not even paying attention. You're not even going after it. Well, the word gospel has no relation to an idea of humans finding their way to God. This is the gospel's great blow to the world's understanding of salvation. You see this, interestingly, in a lot of apologies lately for indiscretions and public sin, saying, I need to, what? Right all my wrongs. I need to earn back what was lost. When it comes to God, there's no talk of that. Every religion says that we can search for God and find it, and only Christianity says no, that God has to search for you and find you. In fact, God has come to you. God has left heaven to come and to die for you. He could have set it up an entirely different way, but no one would find him. Only Christianity says that God was not someone who needed to be appeased. God was not someone who needed people to come and grovel towards him. God was the one who came to the people even though they didn't know they needed to be found. This is the heart of the Christian faith. And it's a direct confrontation to the Pharisees who think that if people just followed their religious path, they would find in themselves a God to be found. Jesus says, I'm the one doing the seeking and the finding. I'm coming to them. And believe it or not, you're going to have to realize, these Pharisees over here, that I even came down for you. They don't think they need that. And the truth is, many of us are in the same way. it's very hard to come to a point in which we need to admit that we need God, that we are helpless in order to save ourselves, that God coming to us is something that was necessary. We may think it's nice and read about it in the Bible and proclaim it to others that Jesus died for me, but often we don't really believe it because we have yet to have crushed within us the sense of we have found it. We own it. We figured it out. The unique thing about this these parables are that typically the ones that are lost read these parables and they're moved to tears to describe the depths of the love of the one who would seek after them and find them. We do this. We read the prodigal son story over and over again, don't we? And we read it and we think, we have examples of it, and we're just absolutely moved to tears that a father would run out and welcome his lost son home. And that's good, and that's right. It's exactly what Jesus is communicating to these people. But Jesus' original audience of Pharisees would have been horrified by this story. You ever thought about that? That these Pharisees and tax collectors in hearing this, these parables would have thought, this is awful. They would have been shocked and horrified because Jesus upset so many social and religious conventions in this single chapter. No, Jesus, they don't be deserved to be searched for. They need to get their lives in order. No, Jesus, you don't leave a good sheep in the fen to find the stupid lost one. It's lost. You pay attention to us. We are the ones who day in and day out, the 99 have been staying in the pen. We've been faithful. We deserve the attention, not the lost one. No, Jesus, you don't tear apart your house to find a coin. And you certainly don't call your friends to tell you you lost it. You don't run out to meet a son in the lost road. You make him come to your door. You make him grovel at your feet. You don't have to show mercy. For Jesus to say that these people whom the Pharisees are disdaining are worth searching for, and for Jesus to say that the Pharisees, the religious ones, own understanding of salvation is wrong, would be deeply disturbing to that audience. And it's no surprise that we read again and again in these texts, later they went out to plot to kill him. So as we look at these parables, our first step right now is to listen to God's word in the same way, is to allow our own simplistic understanding of sin to be shattered. It's not just simply dirt that can be washed off with the newest formula. It's deep. It's ingrained. It has a lot of factors. It obviously has a lot of factors in our own life. Describing those categories, they're in all of us in a variety of ways. And the second, of course, is to begin to shatter our own understanding of salvation, which is to say that somehow we have the capacity to do for ourselves that which only God can do through Jesus Christ. And then we begin the process of living for Him. That can be done. But saving ourselves can't. And when we begin to look at salvation that way, we begin to see that there's no boasting anymore. For we have our faith in the one, as Hebrews 12:2 puts it, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. He was the joyful seeker, the one who went to his death for us because of the joy he had in the mission to save us and to set us free. And when we begin to believe this, we will be able to say with all matter of honesty, the words of a poem I want to read. We're going to try to find some music, actually, to go with this great old poem. It's a poem by Isaac Watts, a great hymn writer. No more, my God, I boast no more of all the duties that I have done. I quit the hopes that I held before to trust the merits of thy Son. Now for the love I bear his name, what was my gain I count my loss. My former pride I call my shame and nail my glory to his cross. The best obedience of my hands dares not appear before thy throne, but faith can answer thy demands by pleading what my Lord has done. Read that last line again. The best obedience of my hands dares not appear before your throne, but faith in the Lord can answer those demands by what? Pleading what my Lord has done.